Whether you find yourself at your summer house or Parliament House this festive season, keeping an eye on what's new on the newsstands can be a little bewildering. But when the cycle starts spinning just too quickly to keep up with, sometimes it's worth revisiting an old familiar friend. From Mayfair to Mexico, we'll examine our picks of the season today on The Stack. On today's programme, Peter York gives us a sneak peek of his December reading.
World of Interiors is a sort of worldly magazine, and the House and Garden editions are very much of their nation. And this is for well-off, couth English people.
Plus, we'll touch down in Mexico for the world's second biggest book fair in Guadalajara.
The fair is important because we can reach the books of our fellow Latin Americans without the market from Spain.
All that coming up on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. We'll head to Mexico soon, as promised. But first, my guest today is noted for his keen eye for good taste, whether in the home, out in the garden, or indeed at the office. Frankly, anywhere. He's the management consultant, cultural commentator, Peter York. Peter, welcome back to The Stack.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us, as always. You have a stack of magazines, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But first of all, let me just ask you, I guess, generally about how we find you and how you find your natural habitat here in London, particularly at this time of year. Always interesting to get your sense of, you know, the latest trends, not just in publishing, but more broadly. And I know you've been sharing your insights with, well, certainly with The Nation in a recent BBC programme and so on and so forth. What's dominating your thinking at this time of year? Are you in a fun, festive mind?
Or are you
in a despairing place?
Yes, but, of course. And people festivise me, and it's very, very nice, and I'm eternally grateful, and I fear missing out, so I go to a lot of things, and then I have to have a lie down, because I get a bit tired.
But you seem in such fine fettle.
But I am obsessed with everything that's on the cover of The New Statesman.
Now, for the benefit of our listeners, remind them what is depicted.
What is depicted is the Trump apocalypse, which has the face of Trump on a sort of mushroom cloud thing that's very, very bright red and mad looking.
And does that kind of sit rather comfortably, Peter, with your view of where the world is as a result of his success?
And there's no point in being ironic about it. It is a most extraordinary and a deeply disturbing thing. And people who claim to be ironic about it are just being equivocal about letting their own feelings out or wanting to be clever or not feeling on top of it. Mm. I feel completely on top of it and I think it's ghastly.
And tell me a little bit then about the media. Before we get into even magazines, if we look across the publishing, the whole print spectrum, how's the job been done, do you think? Let's say the newspapers here in this country, they did document the sort of approaching Armageddon, or do you think they've not been up to the task? And it's interesting because even if we go right back to sort of Brexit days, people pointed the finger, didn't they, at the various media.
What I think is completely fascinating is how parochial a lot of clever people, both in politics and political reporting, have been, failing to understand the impact of new media on all this. And we know that new media had an impact because of the whole Facebook false fact turmoil, failing to understand that there are new voices in place, failing to understand the dynamic of all that stuff, which isn't just about poor left-behind people. That's part of it, but it's not all of it. When I talk to people about what I call the key American books, the key American people, clever people who I greatly respect and great bylines or political names don't know it. Mm. And I've been absolutely astonished at that. So they didn't know until recently what was going to hit them.
And so do you think that the media then has a case to answer in terms of keeping up what we would, I guess, call traditional standards of journalism, whether that's verifying stories, telling people the facts of the matter? Did they fail? Or do you think in some respects some of these social pressures were almost irresistible? They had so much force, whether it was driven by social media or other pressures?
I think there was a failure of getting out there, a failure to listen to people who weren't like oneself, a failure to distinguish what people said from what they meant, which is the skill that I and lots of other people like me, market researchers, actually have. It's your job, if you do what I call A-level clever market research, to distinguish what people mean from what they say. So a simple vox pop, go to a northern town, do a vox pop, go back to London and say these people feel left behind. That isn't the half of it.
And so I guess there's also issues around polling and the accuracy of what people say to people. Is your feeling, therefore, that we need to, rather than the sort of anti-intellectual dynamics, which is Michael Gove's this world espouse, we should be freshly trusting, as you say, people who have tried and tested the methodology?
You've got to work harder, but you've got to be aware what you're focusing on. And people took the referendum here and the American election as if it was business as usual. And it wasn't. Everything was different.
What about the role of satire, Peter? Perhaps we can talk when we talk about your magazines later. I know you don't have necessarily any satirical mags in there, but a lot of people have said, well, the difficulty now, whether it's Brexit, certainly with Trump, is it's impossible to satirise the unsatirizable. You know, he's beyond satire. Is that true, or do you think there is still a role for comedy to play?
I sort of watch, because I watch an enormous amount of YouTube, I watch Alec Baldwin being Trump on Saturday Night Live.
But can he be as ridiculous as the real thing?
Well, the answer is it's not very funny to me. It really isn't very funny. I mean, I think you can write with a cutting edge about it. And somebody who does write with a cutting edge about all this stuff from an American perspective, not very well known here, is Thomas Frank, who is completely brilliant and wrote about what partly gave rise to Trump, which was the failure of the Democratic Party to focus on its original constituency of working class America. And when he's doing it, he's very funny. He goes at the beginning of the book, which it came out in America, before the election result. He went to a Hillary Clinton rally, and it's all full of identity politics and women of the world and all this stuff, which couldn't, in a situation like this, be more irrelevant.
He is very good. And he was a guest on the Monocle Weekly a few months ago, Peter. We tracked down
very excellent people.
We'd like to hear from Thomas Frank. We'd like to hear from you, Peter York, as well. And Peter, when we come back after a short break, we're going to talk more about the magazines you've brought in today. So stay tuned to The Stack. It may come as a surprise to some that the city of Guadalajara is home to the world's second largest book fair. We sent our contributor Tom Smith off to this year's event, where he spoke to Leon Villegas from the small independent publishing house Arquine.
So I'm here with Leon Villegas from Arquine,
which is an independent publishing house?
Yes.
Based in
Mexico City.
Okay, and how long have you been in existence?
Next year, Arquine turns 20.
Who founded it?
Miquel Adrià. He's an architect from Barcelona.
So are all the books architecture orientated?
Yeah, we also have some books about industrial design and urban design, but mostly of architecture.
So I see that you have a book about the making of Reforma 27, a striking building on Reforma by Alberto Calac, one of the most important Mexican architects right now.
Yes.
Something on the Anthropological Museum.
It's about Pedro Ramírez Vázquez, one of the most important architects of the 20th century in Mexico. We also have this area of history of modern architecture in Mexico.
So your range of architecture, urbanism and design books. And you have your own magazine.
Yeah. It actually, Arquine started as a magazine. It still is our like a flagship product, but books have gotten quite intense in last years.
And so the magazine sells for 95 Mexican pesos or 10 US dollars or 7 euros.
Right? Yeah.
And you sell it around the world or mainly in Mexico?
Mainly in Mexico, but we also distribute it in Latin America and in the United States.
Business is looking up for you?
Yeah, it's healthy, yeah. Really, really great.
Who are your main customers?
For the magazine, mostly professional architects, but also a lot of students of architecture and design.
And how many issues a year?
It is quarterly. We are about to launch the winter issue.
So I'm here with Javier Angulo from Territorio magazine. Could you tell me a bit about your magazine?
We do independent journalism. It's about the city because we like to think the city as a social phenomenon and try to explain it by the stories that we like to write.
So it's a magazine. How many issues per year?
12, because it's monthly and it's only digital. We don't have it in paper. This is an independent project and we like to maintain our independence.
If you were on paper, you'd have to have backers or you'd be less independent, you'd have to have finances.
Yes, because in that way we'd have to sell advertising. That economic model tends to be a compromise that we don't want to have.
Okay, and so tell me something that you looked at in your last issue or that you're looking at in your next issue, some theme that you're looking or story that you're looking at.
The most recent is a story about swingers, because that is an underground scene here in Guadalajara, and we have a female co-worker who went and explored that scene.
And did it reveal anything about Guadalajara?
Yes, because this is a society very conservative, but at the same time there's a liberal side, a very liberal side that we like to cover.
So you're based in Guadalajara. You only write about Guadalajara or you write about other Mexican cities or
yes,
places?
We write mostly about Guadalajara, but we have texts from the other cities of Mexico. We're making more collaborations with people of the other cities of Mexico and every once in a while even people from other countries.
But you have no plans to relocate, you're going to stay here?
Yeah, we're going to stay here, but we have a project too that we call Territorio Nómada. That is, we go to a city, we spend a week there and make an issue about that city.
Guadalajara is in many ways the center of modern Mexican culture. Is that part of the reasons that you're here? Or is it because you're from here or you came to study here? Why the location?
I think it's about the characteristic of the city, because we, the people that we work in territory, we're not from Guadalajara, but we all came because it's a very attractive city.
Leon Villegas from independent publisher Arquine. Well, the climate for journalists around the world has become rather more challenging lately, not least in Mexico. Tom Smith also spoke to Jorge Perez from El Informador, Guadalajara and Jalisco State's oldest newspaper.
I think that the book fair is stronger every year because of its business part. The book is 9 days long, but the business fair is only 2 days. And it's not only for Mexico or the local market for selling books, it's for signing contracts between translators, editors, agents. It's a huge business that takes place in this fair, and many people are not aware of that because it's like closed these 3 days to general public. And it's more than just a Mexican economic also. There are here agents from Croatia, from United Kingdom, from France, and they make business between them. Sometimes the contracts that are signed here are not for books that are going to be published in Spanish or in Mexico or even in Spanish, because sometimes the book fair is like an extension also of the negotiations that take place in Frankfurt.
Can you expand on that, the extensions of what goes on in Frankfurt?
One of the reasons that this book fair has grown such a long way in the business place is because it's placed after Frankfurt. Sometimes the editors, the publishers, the agents start making the contact in Germany, in Frankfurt, and they close the deal here in Guadalajara because it's a month and a half after, and they have time to check all the contract, all the conditions of the business.
So the second biggest book fair in the world, they closed the deal.
Jorge Perez from El Informador newspaper speaking to Monocle's contributor Tom Smith. This is The Stack on Monocle 24, our print industry review programme. Peter York is still with me, I'm delighted to say. Peter, we touched earlier in the programme about the cover of the New Statesman with their Trump apocalypse. Quite frightening, quite the perfect capturing of the essence of what he's doing. aside from the obvious appeal of that cover and how neatly it encapsulates the threat, I guess, they say a threat to the world order, what else is it about the way that the New Statesman covers this or covers other issues that still chimes with you?
They're not being ironic. They're not being above it all. They're saying it's a disaster, an American tragedy. Trump's new fascism, you know, that's very out there. And people think, that's naive to say it's about fascism. You know, it's naive or wrong-headed to draw parallels with the between wars situation because everything has changed. But you're hearing a lot of the same rhetoric, including a lot of the same themes. So why not?
And I mean, what kind of editorial stance do you think that involves? Does that come from the top down? Is that an editor, someone like Jason Cowley, saying, look, you know, we must say it as it is. We must confront the threats as we see it. Is there a worry, as you say, that maybe, I don't know, shareholders or other stakeholders are concerned about summoning that kind of historical spectre? What sets that kind of editorial barometer? Does it always come from, the editor, the editor-in-chief?
I think it does. I can't speak for the New Statesman, because I don't know its workings well enough. I'm not sure I've ever written for it. I'd quite like to write for it, is the truth of the matter, because it's so interesting.
Well, that's good. Well, there you go. You've made your availability nice and clear. Yeah. Hopefully they'll be in touch.
Yeah.
I guess then in your dealings with some other organisations, and you've written so widely across such a broad spectrum, who do you most like working for? Is it somewhere where, in a way, there isn't a specific expectation, where you're given particular license? Or do you actually rather like, sometimes, if you're tasked with something very specific?
I like both things, and it depends what the shape of the platform and how often you write and so on. I like the discipline of writing a relatively formatted, I'll explain what I mean by that, weekly column for the Sunday Times. I love doing that, and I love the Sunday Times, the whole Sunday Times thing, and I went last week to the Sunday Times business party, and it was very interesting because it wasn't just business. There was a crosscut between business and politics and the yachts and stuff, and it was very, very interesting. So I love that whole experience, and I love the push me pull you that I do each week with Helen Davis, my section editor, as to what I should do that week. And that is great fun. And the core of it is a sort of, not completely tightly, never depart from it format, but the idea is what somebody, not me, a clever writer called Andrew Ginger, calls interiorography. So the sight of somebody's soul, or at least their sociology, through their place. So a typical thing there would be Donald Trump through the Trump penthouse on the corner of Fifth Avenue in East 57th Street.
Well, again, it's in that you couldn't make it up.
It's very Trumpy.
You couldn't fictionalise it at all.
It's very Trumpy. It's exactly what you would expect, and then some.
Well, Peter, let me ask you a slightly cheeky hypothetical then. Let's say someone said, look, I would love nothing more than to read Peter York's insights on the inner workings of the Trump psyche, on the inner workings of the Trump, all of this OTS decoration, all that stuff. Would you jump on a plane and head straight over? Would you have any reservations?
Well, in a sense, no. I mean, I've done it. There are lots of pictures of Trump's house, his flat, rather, because he's a show-off. Do you know? And everything about it is ghastly. I'm not sure that he fully understands how ghastly it is, but to the liberal elite like me, it's ghastly.
You're part of that metropolitan liberal elite.
Liberal elite. Of course I am.
Does part of you, Peter, I wonder, does part of you almost admire, whether it's bloody-mindedness of Trump, whether it's just arrogance, whether it's sheer narcissism, is there part of you that can almost admire that side of his personality? Or is the flip side of it simply too awful?
Because the thing about Donald Trump is there's no self-mocking in it. There's no light and shade. There's no layers. There's no irony there. As his ghostwriter, the person who really wrote The Art of the Deal, said, what you see is what you get, brackets, be very worried about that.
Yeah, that was quite extraordinary to hear from him. What about The Spectator? You have that here as well.
Another venerable institution full of a lot of very clever people who are sort of very equivocal about Trump. do you know, they're certainly not going to go right out and condemn Trump. And indeed, here is Freddie Gray, the deputy editor, saying, it is odd when someone you know becomes a world-famous Nazi, ha-ha.
And there you go.
Know, because he knows Mr. Spencer, who is the person who did that Washington rally with Nazi salutes. And he's sort of saying, and a sort of not saying, and you don't know what is meant by this, that he, like Milo Yiannopoulos, is having fun. Mm. All I'd say to that is the people on the receiving end of that don't see it as fun. They see it, depending on who they are, either as an invitation to do that sort of thing or to be very afraid, because whatever ironies there may be contained in his stance or people attribute to him, in the retelling, it's not ironic.
No, it's lost quite quickly. Mm. Just on that issue of equivocation, Peter, it strikes me as interesting. A lot of people were rather critical of various Western political leadership, if we take it out of the media realm for a second, and said, well, hang on, why has everyone said, oh, well, we look forward to working with Mr. Trump, and of course it will be a challenge, but we are. And people said, look, they should have been much more, there should be much more ready condemnation. Do you understand the, I guess, the political expediency of that? Or do you think people should have been more? But should they have been more outspoken, perhaps?
No. There's nothing they can do. He is about to be, apparently, the legitimately elected head of state of a very major nation, ally, whatever. You've got to work out how to deal with it. There's nothing you can do about it.
And it's going to be, well, it's, some people have got their work cut out, haven't they, in the months ahead. Yeah. Peter, let's have a change of pace. Now, we did touch upon interiors, albeit very briefly, and they were the OTOs and shimmering gold interiors of Trump's Desres in Manhattan. But let's talk about the world of interiors. We're rattling through the venerable titles. This, of course, a Condé Nast publication, and you've brought along a copy of that with you again.
And I brought along the latest copy of that. And it's full of lovely, subtle, clever, liberal elite-type interiors. No boldly goldly in here. It's all, you know, very fascinating. And it, the thing about interiors is it is a magazine for aesthetes, for art directors, people like that. So it is about interiors rather than houses or flats. You know, there are interiors in interiors which are schlosses that no one lives in, or old Parisian offices, or because they look interesting. And so they're very interesting to people who might want to recreate such a space in a film. But not to ladies who want to do their front room nicely.
No, exactly. With a nice bit of furnishing. I should say my sister works at the World of Interiors, so I should make an honest declaration of interest in case we, if we just say nice things about it.
So it is nice.
So I declare away. What is interesting and always strikes me about World of Interiors, though, and we look at it obviously every month, it's not, doesn't seem outwardly to worry too much about going with the times. You know, people talk about like evolving media models and all of this. There's a reassuring familiarity, isn't there, about interiors. And I guess that's nice. And it reassures the reader as well, doesn't it? It has a reassuring quality.
Quality product, traditional format. Wasn't traditional in 1981 when it came out. It was quite revolutionary. But the point about it, it's concerned with quality and singularity, not with easy modishness. Mm. And certainly not designer land modishness, which dates very fast. It's amazing how fast that stuff dates.
And yet, we see so many titles and brands who want to chase pell-mell after exactly that kind of thing and seem not to have learnt the lessons of history. Why do you think, Peter, that people are so maybe slow to learn these often, lessons that have been proven several times?
I mean, we've been through a period of infatuation with new design. And during the 90s, British people really were interested in new design, and it was good because there was a swamp to be drained, a design swamp to be drained from the 80s. And it's quite understandable. It was a cleaning, cleansing. But that it would be mad thereafter to say ornament is crime. Absolutely balmy. And they don't. They say, you know, here is a variety of places, all of which are singular, interesting. And imagine yourself in that space rather than have this now, get this now.
And what about the broader point? I think, I guess, particularly if we look more to maybe the more of the fashion end of the magazine spectrum, there's a, is there, would it be fair to say, a reluctance to embrace things that are unashamedly beautiful? And often art directors or the commissioners are looking more at challenging and,
yes,
you know, pushing the envelope. Why do you think
pushing
people are
envelope,
reluctant
challenging,
to just... But why fear just engaging with things that are simply beautiful to look at?
Because there's, I mean, a very, very... One is to make yourself seem more singular. Because recognising beauty and putting it across to people, a lot of other people will recognise it. It's very instantly compelling, often. Whereas singularity, a lot of people want to seem singular, and it's a sort of teenage thing that people don't grow out of sometimes. Let's not be shy of being obvious, gorgeous and obvious.
Peter, time is short, so let's turn to your final title you've brought along. And somewhere and lurking in the pile, you have House and Garden. Tell us a bit
house
about your,
well,
your experience
house and
with this.
Is about houses and gardens, mainly for couth English people. World of Interiors is a sort of worldy magazine, rather like, if I may say this, Wallpaper is a sort of worldy magazine. They're slightly different in their focus, but it's a worldy magazine. They're both. And House and Garden, the House and Garden editions are very much of their nation. Mm. And this is for well-off couth English people.
So how do you specifically tailor a product to that quite particular demographic?
The way you do it is by employing a lot of couth English people to run it, because they know, one instinctively knows when something is right.
And that's the trick.
That's the trick, and they do it brilliantly. They do
it.
You have to update to a certain degree and recognise that sometimes your brother who's gone off the rails does rather like modern architecture. So, you know, we've got to have a piece for him. He might have married a person from another country that might have...
Heaven forfend.
All this sort of thing happens and you have to recognise it. But at the heart is the hearth and a really nice chimney piece, which, as you know, is the proper word in House and Garden land as opposed to fireplace. A really nice chimney piece anchors your life and gives you a focal point.
What are we talking about? Ingle nooks?
We're talking about this sort of thing. There's
very nice.
Actually, there are better examples.
Is that chimney sort of Victorian or is that, I'm not sure, Edwardian
that
perhaps?
That looks Edwardian to me.
Yeah.
But it's something, it's what I call a robber baron chimney piece.
It's very elegant.
It's elegant, but it's got the robber baron touch. I mean, it's a bit oversized.
Chimney pieces.
And there is a flat, a small flat, in my square.
No, is it
in
really?
My very square. I can recognise it. It's the flat of a French investment bankery type person who I don't know. And it was fixed up and advised on by my wonderful, very, very design sensitive neighbour, Natalie Hanbrough, who is herself a French person.
There you go.
So a bit of internationalism there.
And nothing wrong with
nothing
that.
Nothing wrong
Peter.
With that.
We're always the first to applaud. Peter York, it's a joy to have you with us. Thanks very much for being on The Stack.
My great pleasure.
And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course to our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome, but do try and be nice. Drop a note to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next Saturday. You can always listen again, if you're going to miss us before that, at the website, via iTunes, or on your preferred podcast platform. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.